This message comes from NPR sponsor Acorn TV. Acorn TV is brilliant television told brilliantly. From charmingly cozy mysteries to daringly dark dramas, visit acorn.tv for a 30-day free trial with promo code NPR. Acorn TV. Brilliant.
Hello, hello. I'm Brittany Luce, and you're listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR, a show about what's going on in culture and why it doesn't happen by accident. All right, y'all, we've got the Golden Globes under our belts, and with that, award season has officially kicked off. And there's one movie that I love that's been getting a lot of buzz and nominations. It's American Fiction.
These books have nothing to do with African-American studies. They're just literature. The blackest thing about this one is the ink.
I don't decide what sections the books go in, and no one here does. That's how chain stores work.
It's a satire of making and selling black art in America today. It's a rich film and a fantastic directorial debut from Emmy-winning writer Cord Jefferson. It's also stacked with an incredible cast: Tracy Ellis Ross, Erica Alexander, and the incredible Jeffrey Wright.
I'm just going to put them back after you leave.
Don't you dare, Ned. Do not you dare.
It's hilarious and moving, and my husband and I did not shut up about it for nearly 3 hours after it was over. But still, I couldn't quite square the film's commentary with the black art of today. Could it be that its satire is feeling a little past its sell-by date? We've kind of moved beyond the era of gangster rap stereotypes and good-bad binaries about representation, right? That's what we're getting into today with Pop Culture Happy Hour's Aisha Harris, who wrote an essay about the longer history of Black Hollywood satire and whether or not American Fiction is actually speaking to this era of Black art. All that coming right up.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Discover. Here's a familiar situation. You have a question about your credit card. You call the number for help and can't get a hold of anyone. If only you had a Discover card. With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. A real person. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. This message comes from NPR sponsor REI Co-op. REI has gear, clothing, classes, and advice for camping and glamping, biking and hiking, axing and snacksing, backpacking, and another outdoor thing that rhymes with backpacking. Visit your local REI Co-op or REI.com for the million and one ways you can opt outside.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Acorn TV. Acorn TV isn't just good, it's brilliant. With exceptional television from around the world, their romances are more charming, their mysteries cozier, their noirs more gripping, and their comedies cleverer. More clever? Oh, you get it. Acorn TV is brilliant stories told brilliantly. Visit acorn.tv for a 30-day free trial with promo code NPR. So, in a nutshell, Acorn TV. Brilliant.
Aisha, welcome back to It's Been a Minute.
Hey, Brittany.
Hello, hello, hello. I am so excited to have you here. We're talking about this movie, American Fiction. Mm-hmm. For those who have not seen American Fiction, what is this film about?
Yeah, so Jeffrey Wright plays Thelonious Monk Ellison. I don't know if you can hear all the references right there, the many. And he's a moderately successful novelist whose latest manuscript is too esoteric for the publishers to really be interested in it. And he notices that what's hot in the lit world right now are stories about uneducated, hypersexualized Black people who live in ghettos. And he's very, you know, not happy about this. And so out of spite, and at first as a joke, he decides to craft the most exaggerated version of this kind of book he can possibly think of under the pseudonym of Stag R. Lee. And he and his agent craft this backstory for Stag where he is like this... He's basically, they claim he's a wanted fugitive.
Fugitive, yes, yes. Who also served time in prison.
Yes. And so that way he'll be insured to stay anonymous. And of course, unsurprisingly, the publishers jump on this immediately. He's offered like a 6-figure deal. He also gets a movie offer. So it kind of plays into his expectations, but then he finds himself sinking deeper and deeper.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you wrote about it recently for NPR.org. And as you wrote, and as we know, this film is based on Percival Everett's 2001 novel, Erasure, which is, yes, you know, a satire of the publishing industry from 20 plus years ago. Can you take us back to 2001, like the world that Erasure was satirizing? And like, what was that era like?
2001 was a very weird time for Black media. When you think about it, you know, at this time, we've got sort of this fallow period for TV where, mm-hmm, classic Black sitcoms, especially of the 90s, were either had already ended or were coming to an end, whether you're thinking about Martin, Living Single, Moesha. Right. And then on top of this, you have the movie landscape that's like primarily dominated by Will Smith and Denzel when it comes to Black actors. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there's very limited roles for Black people, both on TV and in film.
Mm.
And then on top of that, like, Percival Everett is specifically commenting on, supposedly, I don't know if he's ever said this on the record, but the fictional book within the book, which is called My Pathology, yes, with an F.
Yes.
And then is later retitled to a word that we cannot say on NPR, but yes, suffice it to say, it starts with F.
Yes.
That book seems to be clearly satirizing Precious, or Push, a novel by Sapphire, which, mm-hmm, became the movie Precious. And that movie/book, if you recall, is about a young woman, a young girl who is a mother. She is pregnant again, and she's being molested by family members. It's just very, very dark and bleak.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, I can understand where Percival Everett was coming from, because this was a very weird time where we had one sort of image in the form of like the rare, you know, A-list Hollywood movie stars like Will and Denzel. Mm-hmm. But then on the other hand, we also just had, you know, no one else could really get to that status in that way. Yeah, it was a weird time.
To kind of zoom out, American fiction is one of an established tradition of Black filmmakers satirizing the state of Hollywood for Black filmmakers and actors and producers. And obviously with American fiction, this kind of extends to the publishing world as well.
Yeah.
In your essay, you bring up Spike Lee's Bamboozled, CB4 with Chris Rock, and Robert Townsend's Hollywood Shuffle. And all of those movies are still beloved by audiences today. They still strike a nerve with audiences today. Why do these films remain classics?
I think because they are so steeped in their time period. And it's weird to think about, right? Because when we think about comedy, often, and I think correctly, we think comedy does not always age well, especially,
right,
there are exceptions, of course, but like a lot of things do not age well. But I think satire gets away with it a little bit better, because often things that are being satirized are things that are still persistent to today.
Hmm.
And so, you know, Hollywood Shuffle, Robert Townsend's feature debut, he plays an up and coming actor who has to face this dilemma where he finally gets cast in a movie as a lead, but he has to play like a jive talking pimp.
Yes. Yeah, Bobby. Bobby, I need a little more black. You know what I'm saying? Like, stick your ass out, you know, bug the eyes. You know how they move, you know?
Yeah, jive ass.
Let's go again.
Okay, sorry, Sydney.
And so he faces this crisis of his conscience. And in 1987, at the time that movie came out, that was a real thing. Like, unless they were Eddie Murphy, they were being like cast as pimp number two or like drug dealer,
right,
but number five, like all of those things. And the same thing could be said for Bamboozled and CB4. CB4 is about Chris Rock playing the suburban guy who steals the identity of a real gangster in order to like pretend and make his way in the hip hop world.
I'm black, y'all, and I'm blacker than black, y'all.
And in 1993, that's arguably like the peak, or like the end of the peak of gangster rap.
Gangster rap, yeah.
So it feels like fresh, and all of its targets were very pointed and direct and made sense. With American fiction, it's a little murkier there. I'm sure you also have ideas about like how the satire is playing out here, and whether that rings true or not.
Well, I want to hear more from you. Like, even though this vein of satire is kind of a perennial theme for Black filmmakers. You know, you said in your review and you shared just now that the commentary on the media industry, on the publishing world, or on Hollywood felt a little bit out of time or behind the times to you. Talk to me about that.
We've seen these kind of like white people being so eager to just like eat up the most degrading and like awful images of Black people. And what I wanted from American Fiction was it to take it a little bit further. It didn't feel quite as weird, or it didn't go as far as like the blackface in Spike Lee's Bamboozled, which also ends with like people dying. And I think
that took a dark turn.
It takes a dark turn.
It takes a dark turn.
But Spike goes for it, right? And I think here there's like a little bit of pulling back. I think that like for me, if we're going to keep harping on these similar ideas about Blackness and how white people respond to it, I need it to be either weirder or speaking more directly to what is actually a bigger problem. Mm-hmm, I think the bigger issues right now are like the police brutality narratives that keep coming up or have come up in the past, or the trauma narratives when it comes to slavery.
They're interested in how to be anti-racist or very flat, perhaps pleasing satire for them of white professional spaces.
Exactly.
That also feels like something that I see like across entertainment and media as well.
Right.
You brought this up in your essay, and this is something that I noticed as well,
yeah,
that I interpreted as some sort of artistic choice that like the movie doesn't engage with things like Black Twitter or Black critics.
Right.
They say Twitter is dead. I'm like, the discourse still is still, there's always some type of discourse still unfolding somewhere.
I mean,
it's
Cat,
happening.
Cat Williams.
Cat Williams, I mean, he
recently,
very recently revived the app with discourse. To me, something that I would have loved to have seen is like, I feel like Stag R. Lee, like Monk, would have been invited on The Breakfast Club. I feel like Charlemagne would have been like, we gotta go.
Oh my goodness. Yes.
And I enjoyed a lot of the movie, but something I would love to have seen more engagement with Black audiences within the film, because I feel like there was a missed opportunity there for some good intra-community conversations.
Yeah, and I think that's partially just the way this movie is crafted. You know, in the book Erasure, it's a lot more free-flowing and free-form, and it isn't as beholden to like a linear narrative. But with this, it's just really interesting because it is probably even more of a family drama than it is a satire. And I think that's
and the family drama is
that I drama-ing.
Loved. It is good.
It is so juicy. Good. In fact, I would have liked seeing that on its own more.
Family drama was just so gorgeously executed and beautifully written, and like, and the performances were amazing. And I really, really, really was into that.
Yeah.
But the thing I also can't help but think about, kind of like a commentary on the commentary on the commentary, is that I don't think that a family drama about those characters just having problems would have, I don't think it would have been greenlit without that satirical angle. You know, I was like, oh, I wonder what it would have been like if the film were just about this family. And I was like, oh, it never would have been made at this level with these resources. Never would have been made.
Yeah, that's a thing. I think it would have been made, just not, it would not be getting the Oscar push. It would not probably have a lot of these actors in it.
True.
And, you know, I think that is the conundrum, right? Because it kind of does speak to the point that he's trying to make, in a way, is that like this intimate family drama on its own probably wouldn't matter.
Going back to this point about, like, I guess you and I were having an intra-community conversation, but and going back to this idea of intra-community conversation, there is this one pivotal moment in the film where Monk, played by Jeffrey Wright, is finally face to face with his nemesis, Sintara Golden, who's
and
played by Issa Rae.
Only in his mind. She has like
no awareness of him. No awareness of him. But Sintara Golden is the author of Weeze Lives in the Ghetto, this incredibly successful book that has really gotten Monk's goat. Like, he is so mad, and understandably so. It's like it feels like he's being told by the powers that be that this is the kind of book that he needs to write, which doesn't feel natural to him. And she's written that book, even though, like, she came, I believe, from Oberlin and graduated from Oberlin and became a junior book editor for like a major publishing house. So that's not her reality either.
Yeah.
And it's supposed to be this big confrontation. And I felt like there was tension building to this moment because there was a lot of, throughout the film, conversation between white people and black people, right, mm-hmm. about what this book is supposed to mean or what it's supposed to do or who it's for. So this is the first big conversation that two black people are having in private about this book. And I was really excited for that moment. And I wished it would have been longer. Mm-hmm. It kind of got into some notions around selling out. And this is a moment where I was, you know, I mean, I've been a big fan of Cord's writing on television and
same, yeah.
And his journalism for, you know, a long time, back in the Gawker days. Like, you know,
oh man, the Gawker days. He was great.
Like very, very into following his work. And I was like excited for this moment because I was like, I'm going to find out. Mm-hmm. What he thinks. I'm going to find out, like, where's Monk at? And I felt like the conversation could have been longer. And even just being somebody who works in journalism and media, I mean, I want to speak for you, but I feel like that conversation could have gone deeper on some levels and could have gotten really, really intense.
At one point, she does say something really interesting. She says something about being a black woman and, like, why he's chosen to sort of, like, come after her. And I was like, this is true. This
that
feels
is interesting.
but it did feel kind of like the Twitter version of that conversation. And I think, again, to our point earlier about just wishing we had seen more of the outside world, it would have been nice to see him on a podcast. There is like one scene where he's on a talk show, but like that one doesn't seem, I think they were trying to imply that she was like a Wendy Williams type, but we didn't get any Wendy Williams feel it. Like where was that energy? Where was the, you know,
so she was too Tamron Hallified, I think, to really be a true Wendy.
Yes. Yes. So I wanted more of that. Like, and I think that could have helped make that conversation feel less kind of muted than it wound up being. It sounds like for both of us.
It's interesting, like, despite my impressions of the film or your impressions of the film, it's something that's been very consistent throughout, you know, Cord Jefferson's interviews is that he's been saying that, you know, despite his Emmy's win, which he won a writing Emmy for a fabulous episode of The Watchmen.
Yes, my goodness.
Several years ago. And I mean, it was a huge deal. I mean, it was a great episode. It was a well-deserved win. But he said that he still has struggled to be able to get the support, the funding, the opportunities to make nuanced portrayals of Black life that don't involve, you know, some of these trauma porn crutches that we see over and over again. Yeah. He just discussed it on a recent episode of Fresh Air, where he was talking to Tanya Mosley, the phenomenal Tanya Mosley. Mm-hmm. And even though this conversation feels out of time in some ways to some audience members, Monk's complaints clearly are still an issue in Hollywood and publishing.
Yeah.
And I can attest in media and journalism today, some of the things I have seen, heard, and experienced, even though there are aspects of it that feel out of time, it is very interesting that so much of it still hits in a pocket that feels very true.
And that's why I can't hate on this movie too much, even though I know we've been talking about all the issues that we have with it. But at the same time, I don't want to discredit what he or other people in Hollywood might be going through or in the literary world or wherever. That is the conundrum, is that like we keep progressing. And I always want to tell people who are upset about the latest movie about slavery or whatever, I'm just like, there is other stuff being made. Just you have to look for it. Don't worry. Like, it's okay.
Yes. You know, I will say, like, you know, we both have discussed like how much we loved so many aspects of this film. And also, like, for me, I just felt it was so refreshing in so many ways. And the thing that I found myself saying when I got to the end is I was like, I want to watch this again. Like, it like bears rewatching. Like, it's rewatchable in a way that, no disrespect, but like Roots, 12 Years a Slave. I have seen Selma again, but like, I'm not going to sit on a Saturday and be like, you know what? I'm going to turn on Selma. I'm more likely, truthfully, I'm more likely, me and my husband are more likely on a sick day or on a little just kind of cozy day to turn on Why Did I Get Married? Than we are to turn on.
Speaking of
Selma.
Tyler Perry gets a few shout outs in this movie too.
Definitely. I will say, like, I could see American Fiction being a new black comfort watch along those lines. And there's something to me very nice about a new contemporary black comfort watch.
Yeah. I don't think it's touching something like Bamboozled or Hollywood Shuffle or, you know, even Sorry to Bother You. But I do think it is rewatchable. It's made me think a lot. And as frustrating as it is, I still really want people to see it and talk about it. Your mileage may vary with this, but I think just if you haven't seen it, it's worth a watch and talk about it. Jeffrey Wright is giving, I think, one of his best performances ever.
I feel excited about the movement around this movie, it getting a lot of press attention, but also like to zoom out from American Fiction. I do want to say that it feels notable to me that this moment with American Fiction kind of, like with all of the Oscar buzz and the award season, you know, praise that it's been getting, there's a moment happening that feels bigger than this film. Like we have The Color Purple and Origin by Ava DuVernay. And each of these three films are made by Black people about different experiences. They have totally different tones. And not to make everything all about the Academy or the Oscars or whatever, but I don't have a memory of this much diversity in the Black stories that are award season darlings, like conversation, like topic, tone, style, but also high quality. But I mean, you know, in a kind of ironic way, this moment kind of speaks to the idea that the future that American Fiction was hoping for is kind of... it's kind of here.
Absolutely.
In a very interesting way.
Yeah.
Well, Aisha, thank you so much. I had so much fun. I deeply enjoyed watching the film, but I have even more so enjoyed talking about the film.
Yeah.
It's just like, I feel blessed to have a rich text.
Yes. A very rich text. Thank you so much for having me. This is amazing.
That was NPR's Aisha Harris. You can read her essay on American Fiction at npr.org. This episode was produced by me and Barton Girdwood. Our editors are Jessica Plachek and Bilal Qureshi. I'm Brittany Luce, and I'll be back Friday with another episode of It's Been a Minute from NPR.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Sattva. Sattva luxury mattresses are every bit as elegant as the most expensive brands, but because they're sold online, they're about half the price. Visit SAATVA.com/NPR and save an additional $200. This message comes from NPR sponsor BetterHelp. When you're carrying around a lot of stress, therapy is a safe space to get it off your chest. If you're considering therapy, give BetterHelp a try at BetterHelp.com/NPR to get 10% off your first month.
Do you ever wish you could get your stories in 3 hours rather than 3 minutes? Or maybe you're sick of doom scrolling, getting your news in bits and pieces. That is where Embedded comes in. We bring you documentary series that will change the way you think about things. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.